This lesson is from the course Redemptive History and the Regulative Principle of Worship, taught by Dr. Will Wood.
Now that we have covered the object of our worship in God Himself, the subject of worship as man made in the image of God for the task of praise as a homo liturgicus, we can now move on to consider some of the other features and elements of worship in the Old Testament. And the first one that is proper to begin with here is how throughout the Old Testament, even into the New, worship is tied together to a holy place. And specifically, worship is conducted on a holy mountain. Psalm 24:3, who shall ascend the hill of the Lord and who shall stand in the holy place? And so the proper place to start when considering a biblical theology of the regular principle is the theology of place, or the sacred space to worship the God of heaven and of earth. And to do this, we're going to begin first considering creation and the Garden of Eden as a macrocosmic temple and the original Holy of Holies, the original mountain of God, and man's placement on that for the task of worship as kind of an ascent of the original mountain of God. And then consider how after the fall, the reconstitution unto the worship of the Lord is cast as a worshipful ascent through sacrifice up the mountain of the Lord, such that post-lapsarian worship, post-fall worship, is an ascent up the mountain of God through the offering of a sacrifice. So first beginning here with looking at creation in Eden as a macrocosmic and protological temple mountain. So creation in Eden as a macrocosmic and protological temple has been argued by a number of scholars. I'll just mention a close friend of Reform Forum here, and Greg Beale, in his volume, The Temple and the Church's Mission. And I seek to merely outline some of the information that Beale draws our attention to there with one important emphasis for our purposes. And so Genesis 1 and 2, while focusing on creation in Eden, a sort of protological macrocosmic temple, also draws our attention to another temple, a second one, that is made as a special place of God's presence. And it's not the earthly temple, but rather a heavenly temple, a heavenly archetype. So there are actually two temples revealed in Genesis 1 and 2, a heavenly archetypal one and an earthly ectypal one. Meredith Klein helpfully comments on this, saying, quote, the entire lower register, that's his special language for the visible realm, stand in the creation narrative as a continuous series of instances of replication of the upper register glory. That's his phraseology for heaven itself. And he continues, ectypes that provide us with the God language and conceptual imagery for our reflections on the glory heaven until the day when our eyes are opened. And so when we're thinking about the creation of earth and Eden in Genesis 1 and 2, we need to conceptualize them as a reflection, an ectype, of the heavenly reality. And the heavenly temple is created in Genesis 1:1, where it says, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, an act that Klein in his book, God, Heaven, and Harmageddon, calls the big blaze, which is just a fun way of talking about the effulgent nature of God's glory bursting forth into the heavenly scene. Now, some, perhaps most, argue that Genesis 1:1 and the heavens and the earth there form what's called a merism. A merism where you use two opposites of something in order to illustrate a totality. And as a merism, it functions as an introduction to the rest of the creation narrative. It's kind of a heading for the creation that follows in Genesis 1:3 through the end of the chapter and even into chapter 2, verse 3. In distinction from that, it's better to understand Genesis 1:1 and 2 as the first act of creation, with Genesis 1:1 focusing on the creation of the invisible heavens as an archetypal temple, and then Genesis 1:2 drawing your attention to the visible earth, which will be formed and fashioned into an ectypal temple in Genesis 1:3 and following. And I say that because the specific syntax of Genesis 1:1 draws our attention to a distinctive act from Genesis 1:3 and following. It uses what in Hebrew is called a preposed verbal clause, or for all of you other Hebrew nerds out there, an eschatol clause, which has a primary function of providing background information or events necessary for understanding the main narrative, which follows beginning with a different verb form called the vayiktol, which begins in Genesis chapter 1 and verse 3. Which means when we're looking at Genesis 1, 1 and 2, it is syntactically separated from Genesis 1, 3 and following as a separate, distinct act. Genesis 1, 1, the creation of the heavens, the invisible realm where God dwells, and the earth, a visible realm that he is going to then form and fashion into a temple place on earth. Genesis 1, 2 then follows the exact same syntactic structure of Genesis 1, 1, saying, and now the earth was. And it gives us a description of the natural state of the visible realm prior to God's forming and fashioning and filling and illuminating of the earthly realm that begins in Genesis 1 and verse 3. And so Genesis 1, 2 talks about the creation of the visible sphere, the visible realm, the natural world, the visible world, and it describes it in a context of a preformed, pre-filled state, void of light. That is what I think it means when it says the earth was formless and void, and then talks about darkness hovering over the face, or darkness and the Spirit of God hovering over the face of the deep. And so the narrative of Genesis 1, 3 and following then rectifies the situation of formless, void, and dark by forming the various realms, days 1 through 3, filling the various realms, days 4 through 6, and then illuminating it with its luminaries, which you can see on days 1 and day 4. And so the Genesis 1 narrative in 1, 3 through 21 really deals with the forming and the, or 31, excuse me, the forming, the fashioning and the filling of this visible realm that prior to verse 3 of chapter 1 was unformed and unfilled and dark. One final feature of Genesis 1, 2 I think is important prior to dealing to the significance of the earthly realm as a replica of the heavenly one. It's that while Genesis 1, 1 gives us a reference to God generically as creator, Genesis 1, 2 gives us more details as the creative agency as being done by the work of the Spirit, the Spirit of God hovering over the face of the waters. The Holy Spirit as the divine agent of creation here provides us a pattern for creation in accordance with heaven, which is an invisible spiritual realm. The Spirit is the divine architect of heaven, and now also the divine architect of the visible realm, which I believe uses heaven as a sort of a blueprint for the visible realm itself. Meredith Klein helpfully comments along these lines as well in his book Images of the Spirit, where he says, quote, the Spirit of God hovered over the primeval tohu, not only as a creative power, but as a paradigm for creation. The theophonic glory was an archetypal pattern for the cosmos and for man, the image of God. The world of the glory theophany, that's heaven, is a dimensional realm normally invisible to man. And so heaven, the invisible spiritual realm created in Genesis 1:1, forms the archetypal pattern for the visible earthly realm in Genesis 1:3 and following. The Spirit is the creator architect of them both. The Spirit, through divine heavenly fiat, let there be, creates the visible sphere in an ectapal likeness of heaven, and it was so. And the implications for this, I think, are very significant for our discussion. The invisible heavens are a spiritual realm created by God who is Spirit as his holy habitation. Genesis 1:2 then teaches further that the Spirit is the personal agent of the creation of this visible realm. The created, the earth, the visible realm, is created by the Spirit to be a visible replica of the spiritual invisible heavenly reality. As a visible replica of the heavenly spiritual realm created by the Spirit, it also means that there is an embedded, concreated potentiality for the visible realm to advance to an eschatological reality marked by the Spirit as well. Gardas Voss In an article he wrote, Paul's Eschatological Conception of the Spirit, he argues that for Paul, the ideas of pneumatology or spirits and eschatology coincide. And using this same sort of rationale from Voss and his reasoning in that article, we can say that all of creation is made as a natural state with an ability to progress to an eschatological spiritual one. And we can draw an analogy from 1 Corinthians 15, how man is given a natural body with the propensity to proceed or to advance to a spiritual body, a soma psychikon to a soma pneumatikon in 1 Corinthians 15. And so there's a potentiality for transition for man, as well as the realm in which man is created, to move from of the dust to of the spiritual, or to of heaven. To put it a little bit differently, there's an eschatological potentiality to creation that is meant to be gained by covenant and is being revealed to us by the Spirit in Genesis chapter 1, verse 2. Again, Klein helpfully puts it this way. He says, quote, "The two register character of biblical cosmology, relative as it is to man's pre-glorification status, is not permanent. It belongs only to the first stage of an eschatological movement that was integral to creation from the beginning and leads to a final stage of consummation. The initial separation of heaven and earth in Genesis 1:1 looks forward to a day where that separation will be removed. What we have by faith today will be given to us by sight in the new heavens and the new earth." See, the earth, no less than heaven, is a created holy realm, a place fashioned for a proper habitation for a holy God to dwell with and to relate to a holy people. On this read, the repeated refrain of Genesis 1, God's self-evaluation of creating things that are deemed good, it's not the divine pat on the back or merely a declaration of divine competence in his creative work. It's actually a statement of appropriateness, and specifically an appropriateness for this realm to be a place where the perfectly good God would dwell with man made in his image. It's a statement where this place is being fashioned as a holy place for a holy God to dwell with his holy image bearers. A place where man would be created and located for that natural religious fellowship expressed by worship. And so with this background of the archetypal heavenly temple in Genesis 1:1 and 2, and it forming the standard for which earth itself is to be an ectype, I want to now summarize some of the other literature out there on how creation broadly and the Garden of Eden particularly are expressed as holy places for a holy God to dwell with his holy people. Many scholars have noted that various elements of both creation in general and the Garden of Eden in particular bear striking resemblance to the tabernacle and to the temple. Or perhaps better, if we're actually following the canonical order, the temple and the tabernacle bear striking resemblance to the original creation and the Garden of Eden. We'll consider together first the general creation of Genesis 1, and then the particular form of the Garden of Eden in Genesis 2. And a number of important parallels show up between the creation accounts and the tabernacle and temple narratives. Firstly, and drawing our attention again to Genesis 1:2, both the tabernacle and the temple are created by special craftsmen that have an endowment of the spirits of God, Exodus 31 and 1 Chronicles 28, in order for it to be constructed according to the pattern of heaven, Exodus 25:40, 1 Chronicles 28:11 and 12, for the Spirit of God to dwell there. The spirits of God is the agent of the original creation, the agent of tabernacle and temple construction, and what eventually inhabits both the tabernacle and the temple. Second, just as Genesis 1:3 through 2:3 is structured as a sabbatical pattern of 6 days followed by the final seventh sanctified as time unto the Lord, so also the tabernacle instructions follow an order of 6 commands from God, and the Lord said to Moses, followed by a 7th command concerning Sabbath, in Exodus 31:12 through 17. And so tabernacle construction, if you're looking at Exodus 25 through 31, actually follows the pattern of Genesis chapter 1, where it moves in a series of 6 creative days, followed by the climactic 7th in a Sabbath. And then the instructions of Exodus 25 through 31 then have a fulfillment in Exodus 35 through 40. Again, following the same 6+1 pattern, where the sabbatical command of Exodus 31 corresponds to the Spirit coming down off of Mount Sinai and inhabiting the Holy of Holies and the tabernacle. Alan Ross, in his book Recalling the Hope of Glory, I think correctly comments on this, saying, quote, "Correlation between the command and the fulfillment, speaking of the tabernacle, is reminiscent of the way that Genesis 1 was written. God said, and it was so." So whenever we're thinking about the specific tabernacle legislation, the command to construct the tabernacle according to the pattern received on the mountain, Exodus 25, 40, it actually follows the pattern of Genesis chapter 1. The literary structure of Genesis 1 is a temple construction structure. Third, creation, and then the tabernacle and the temples, are places of special illumination. In Genesis 1, 14 through 16, we have the creation of the luminaries in the created order placed in the expanse of the skies. But remarkably, the term that is used for luminaries there, ma'oroth, in the Hebrew, is more properly translated as lamps rather than luminaries. And the only other use of this term in the entirety of the Pentateuch is in reference to the tabernacle, where the tabernacle has within it its lamps, its luminaries. And so the sun, the moon, and the stars are actually the lamps of the creation order, the lamps of the macrocosmic temple that are meant to reflect the effulgent glory, of the shining glory of God's heavenly light. These lamps are also placed in the expanse of the heavens and in the skies, as we would call them. But this expanse is used elsewhere to speak of creation as if it is a pitching of a macrocosmic tabernacle, as it is in Isaiah chapter 40, verses 21 and 22, and Psalm 104, and verses 1 through 4. The expanse, the rakia in Hebrew, is as is described as sort of a tabernacle tent being stretched out and pitched. It's also quite remarkably one of the terms used to describe Ezekiel's chariot throne of God in Ezekiel chapter 1, where the divine light shines in light of the expanse, the rakia, upon which his throne is located. Fifth, the separation of dry land and sea parallels other features in the tabernacle and the temple as well. Part of the separation of dry land would have included the creation of mountains. The separation of a particular region and place for land creatures is ultimately man to dwell on the mountain of God for the praise of God. And these mountains are also called the pillars of the earth in places like Psalm 75, 3, Job chapter 9, verse 6, where if the expanse is the fabric of the macrocosmic tabernacle, then the mountains are the pillars that hold that expanse up in place, the pillars of the sky, as Job 26:11 refers to them. Well, so also the tabernacle and later the temple have their supporting pillars. The tabernacle pillars are the poles that are set up for the maintaining of the expanse of the tabernacle. And of course, in 1 Kings 7, you can read about the pillars of the temple as well. While the pillars hold up the expanse of the skies, they're also separated in Genesis 1 from the sea. Both the tabernacle and the temple are fashioned with a sea in miniature with the bronze basin. You can read in Exodus 30 and 1 Kings 7, 2 Chronicles 4 as well, where the basin is called the sea. And so with this act of the separation of dry land, the forming of the mountains, and the support of the rakia, the creation marks the advent, you could say, of the visible mountain of God, where from the waters of Genesis 1 and 2, now we have a separation of a particular place where land-dwelling creatures and especially man can be gathered to worship and glorify the Lord of creation. Lastly, in Genesis 1, 1 and 3, the dry land is not simply free of water, but it's also full of fruitful vegetation. So also the tabernacle and the temple, the curtains and the walls are full of arboreal imagery, covered in pictures of flowering trees, as well as even some animals located among the temple vestments. From this brief discussion, we could say that the general created order of Genesis 1 is made as a protological temple, a macrocosmic holy realm where a holy God would dwell with a holy people, where the God of the invisible heavens creates a heaven-like visible realm appropriate for religious fellowship. And if this is the case for the broader creation in Genesis 1, it's even more so the case for the particular creation of the Garden of Eden in Genesis chapter 2. So while the relation between the general creation and the Garden of Eden is not fully drawn out in the text of Genesis 1 and 2, I think Michael Morales is correct when he writes in his book, Who Shall Ascend the Mountain of the Lord, that while Genesis 1 portrays creation as a tabernacle, Genesis 2 and 3 portrays the Garden of Eden as something of an archetypal holy of holies, the place of most intimate communion and fellowship with Yahweh God. And we can outline a few of the connections between the Garden of Eden and the tabernacle and temple at this time. The Garden of Eden is the special place of God's presence. God walks about in the Garden of Eden in Genesis 3:8, and the garden is the place of his own particular planting of trees that are for full of fruitfulness and beauty to the eyes. And it expresses, that special act of creation expresses his particular care for it and its distinction even from the rest of the world. And in light of that, second, Eden is a place of particular fruitfulness, where the original garden imagery from creation is heightened and enhanced. The garden is the place where Genesis 2:9 says, every tree that is pleasant to the sight and good for food is planted by God. In relation to the temple, Beale rightly states, quote, the account in 1 Kings 6 and 7 of the temple construction includes a proliferation of garden-like descriptions of the interior, much of which are descriptions of carvings, structures, or pieces of furniture carved with precious metals. See, the inner walls of the temple and even etched into the fabric of the tabernacle were things like flowers and trees and pomegranates and other wonderful garden-like images. And on top of that, even a number of scholars have argued that the temple lampstands and tabernacle lampstands found at the entrance of the Holy of Holies were actually models of the Tree of Life itself. You read about them in Exodus 25, 31 through 39. And so whenever a priest would enter into the tabernacle or into the temple, an unmistakable reality would strike them whenever they entered. And it's that they were entering a garden. They were entering a place of special fruitfulness with full of life and with the lampstands also full of light. Third, Eden and also the tabernacle and temple are full of precious metals and water. These two images are joined together, and so I wanted to treat them together. In Genesis chapter 2, verses 10 through 14, a river flows out of Eden and splits into four and spreads throughout the earth, watering the entire created order. And then the various regions are then filled with precious metals, specifically gold, delium, and onyx. Now, we don't know especially what delium is, but gold and onyx are both used to construct both the tabernacle and the temple, and even used in the high priest garments. You can see scripture references for this in the volume that attends or that is going to come out in accordance with this course. Water was also not only present in the tabernacle and the temple in the sea basins, but was also a key image in the original creation of the Garden of Eden and even the image of the eschatological temple in Ezekiel 47 and Revelation 21. I'm going to draw our attentions there because the waters in those two places is likened unto a river. Just like we have with the waters of the Garden of Eden, flowing forth from the archetypal Holy of Holies, as Morales has called it, and then flowing forth into the concourse of the rest of the earth. Well, so also, the rivers of Ezekiel and Revelation flow from the Holy of Holies, go forth, turns into a raging river, full of life, watering the trees that never wither, that never fade, that have truth, that have fruit that are for eating, from the water that flows from the sanctuary, even in Revelation 21:22, fruits that bear the fruit of the tree, or trees that bear the fruit of the tree of life. Eden was a place full of precious stones, but also a place of life-giving waters. Fourth, that the river flows from Eden shows that Eden is at a located elevation. It is a mountain. Now, this may be assumed in light of the discussion in Genesis 2 of water flowing from Eden. The prophet Ezekiel makes this explicit for us, where he says in Ezekiel 28, verses 13 through 16, talking about Eden, the garden of God, in verse 13, he further identifies it in both 14 and 16 as the holy mountain of God. Eden is the protological mountain of God, an original holy mountain that forms the first version of this and the first connection between mountain and temples that is going to reverberate throughout the rest of the Old Testament, including, for example, Mount Ararat, where Noah is brought to worship after the flood, Mount Sinai, where Israel is brought to worship after the Exodus, and eventually unto Mount Zion, where the temple is going to be located, and especially the eternal Zion, the heavenly Zion, eschatological Zion, where all of God's people are gathered and festal gathering at the end of the age. Fifthly, as we talked about in the previous lesson with the image of God, Adam is commissioned as a guardian priest, king, and prophet of the garden. Adam's charge to work and to keep the garden in Genesis 2:15 ties his task to the priesthood to work and to guard and to keep the tabernacle and the temple. Which would mean to say, if Adam's charge is to be a priest, that Adam's place is to be a temple as well. Lastly, when Adam and Eve are exiled out of the garden in Genesis chapter 3, we find that Eden also has an east-facing gate. As they are exiled toward the east, and a guardian cherub is placed barring their way back into the original Holy of Holies in the Garden of Eden, we find that as the tabernacle and temple face the east, and have guardian cherubim etched upon the curtains or etched into the doors, so also the Garden of Eden. So all of this shows an important reality for worship. It is to be connected to God's holy mountain by a people sanctified for praise. The tabernacle and temple are redemptively reconstituted Eden-like places of God's presence, both of which are, like Eden, created according to the pattern of heaven. The tabernacle in Exodus 25:40, the temple in 1 Chronicles 28:19 are patterned by God himself as he reveals it to Moses, Exodus 25, and David, 1 Chronicles 28, and how they ought to construct these places of God's presence. And so God reveals a heavenly blueprint to Moses and to David on Sinai and on Zion for the construction of his special dwelling places here on earth. And this is the case we'll find throughout the course, not only for their specific physical edifices, but also for their following through of their worship. Both are revealed by God, where the holy place is fashioned in accordance with God's holy mountain, and worship is described as an ascent up the mountain of God, after the fashion which God himself prescribes. See, due to the fall, Adam and Eve, when they were created, they were placed upon Eden, the mountain of God. But in the fall, they are exiled out of God's special place of his presence. And so the tragedy of the fall led to an expulsion off the mountain of God. And with idolatry entering into the scene and a confirmed state of wickedness and sin and misery, man was no longer fit to dwell upon the holy mountain of the holy God. Only true, righteous worshipers of the one true God may ascend the mountain of the Lord, may enter into the holy place of God where his flame-filled presence is found. Now, any attempt to ascend God's holy mount without the requisite holiness marked by true worship and a pure heart leads to death, as it did to Nadab and Abihu in Leviticus chapter 10. As such, after the fall, the worshipful ascent up the mountain of God is done only through the offering up of a sacrifice by a faithful worshiper. And so post-fall or post-lapsarian ascent up the mountain of God into the presence of God is done via an altar at the base of God's holy mountain. And we find this in the earliest chapters of the book of Genesis just after the fall. Mankind exiled out of the presence of God in the Garden of Eden in Genesis chapter 3, then has a worshipful service that we find in Genesis chapter 4. Now, we don't know a lot of information about worship in what's called the primeval history from Genesis 4 through 11. But two narratives stand out in primary importance. First one's in Genesis 4, and the second one is in Genesis 8, both of which highlight worship taking place at an altar by the mountain of the Lord. In Genesis 4, Cain and Abel bring their offerings to an altar that is most likely at the east-facing gate of the Garden of Eden. Now, this seems to be implied, I believe, by how Cain's further exile in light of his sin and murdering his brother Abel is that he is exiled further east of Eden in Genesis 4, 16. And so the locale at the east-facing gate ties the altar worship to mountain theology. Worship at the altar is a means by which man, through the offering up of a sacrifice in accordance with God's word, may ascend back into the presence of God through this liturgical ascent. The worshiper, in offering the sacrifice, would place an animal under the curse of flaming fire and a knife of death, which I think bears the image of the flaming sword of judgment drawn, barring entry back in the presence of God in Genesis chapter 3. The cherubim wields the two main images of judgment in the Bible, in a knife and in fire. And through the sacrificial system, the knife and fire, the judgment of God due unto sin, is applied to the sacrifice in the stead of the worshiper, in the place of the worshiper. And as the judgment against sin is applied onto that sacrifice, the flaming sword that barred entry back into the presence of God is returned back to its sheath that they may ascend the mountain and worship once again. We'll see this more worked out when we consider the foundational place of temple worship in 1 Chronicles 21. The only other altar mentioned in the primeval history is one constructed upon Mount Ararat by Noah after the flood. Now, we don't know much information about Noah's long-term worship, but a few things are worth commenting on Genesis chapter 8 here. First, it's the location of Noah's altar. Noah's altar is constructed on a mountain that reminds us of the original mountain temple in the Garden of Eden. Noah, as he is constructing this altar and worshiping the Lord at it, subsequently plants a vineyard, which increases the connection between the garden and Mount Ararat as well. Ararat, in a sense, is a redemptively regained or recreated Eden-like mountain where now Noah worships at an altar in this redemptively regained mountain place. A second interesting addition with Noah's altar is that Noah offers only clean animals as a sacrifice. Now, thorough legislation concerning clean animals is not given until Leviticus chapter 11. But the Lord did instruct back in Genesis chapter 7 that Noah would take a pair of each animal, but seven pairs of all clean animals, which means that Noah's act of offering up clean animals on the altar in his act of worship is following the divine pattern of setting apart this particular type of animal. Lastly, his worship in Genesis 8:21 is pleasing unto the Lord. And as it is pleasing unto the Lord, it leads to a common grace promise that the world would remain until the end of the age. And that original mandate given to Adam to be fruitful and multiply is reapplied to Noah and to his family. See, Ararat and its altar are the new mountain of the Lord for Noah and for his family. The next altar we find in the Bible is constructed by Abraham. Abraham and the rest of the patriarchal history and its tying together with the altar is connected to another move, redemptive historically speaking, where with Abraham and with the other patriarchs together, the site of the altar is tied together to the promises of the land. And unlike the earlier narratives, the worship of the patriarchal period is tied together to the specific promises of a place given to the descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And the first altar is constructed by Abram in Genesis 12. Upon entry into the land, God appears to him, proclaims his promises that he will have a great nation coming from his line. They'll have a particular place where they will dwell. And he immediately, upon entering, builds an altar in Genesis 12, verse 8. Similarly, in Genesis 13, when Abram moves to the Oaks of Mamre, he hears a reiteration of those promises and he constructs an altar at this place. This altar, in the midst of the oak trees of Mamre, reminds us of the original Eden, which is also covered in fruitful and beautiful trees. It's also the place where the covenant is ratified in Genesis 15, and the promises of Isaac are given in Genesis chapter 17. Now, the altar, in light of Genesis 15, also becomes a place where worship at an altar and worship as a covenant ceremony are joined together. Or in Genesis 15, the theology of sacrifice at the altar is joined together to a covenant ceremony where the Lord comes and makes himself or grants to Abraham, or I guess Abram at this point, a covenant oath through a covenant ceremony where animals are sliced in two, separated out into rows, and the Lord passes through the rows of slain animals in a flaming theophany. And this oath with Abram, as you know the story, asleep out on the side at this point, with the Lord passing through the animals is properly called a self-maledictory oath. An oath where God is swearing himself unto Abram, saying if he doesn't keep his covenant, that he will himself bear the curse for it. One scholar amply comments on this, saying, quote, graphically symbolized in the slain and halved animal, soon to be consumed by the birds of prey, was the curse of dereliction and destruction. To pass through the way between the rows of severed carcasses was to walk through the valley of the shadow of death. Such was the malediction that the Lord continually invoked upon himself. As a covenant oath of self-malediction, Meredith Klein continues arguing and saying in his book Kingdom Prologue that it transpires that though the Lord would not undergo the cursed line of Genesis 15, of the Genesis 15 oath ritual as a covenant breaker, it was nevertheless only by suffering the curse that he would keep this covenant. Whenever we're looking at the development of worship at the altar, it's with Genesis chapter 15 that we start to have greater clarity revealed to us that God himself, through the sending of his own son as the descendant from the woman, is going to be the one who bears the curse of the covenant for his people and in their stead. Another reason why I mention this particular oath ritual is because Genesis 15 and the way that Abram offers up the sacrifices here actually matches the order of the offering in Leviticus chapter 1 for the ascent offering, with the cattle mentioned first, then the sheep and the goats, and then the birds. As such, I believe it's proleptic of Israel's cultic system itself. The entire order of the Levitical sacrifices is here anchored and God's vow of self-malediction. And so the covenant ratification with the Lord's self-maledictory oath forms the redemptive historical seed from which the sacrificial system in the cultic life under Mosaic covenant will eventually blossom forth. And so Israel's cultic system is actually rooted in God's own self-maledictory oath in Genesis 15, which means that it always, on its own terms, was to be understood as looking forward to the day when the covenant Lord would bear the curse of the sacrificial death himself so that the worshipers can then ascend into the presence of God. Now we could mention other altars, other acts of sacrifice like Genesis 22 and the substitutionary sacrifice offered up in the stead of Isaac in that passage. We need to move forward here and think about the revelation of God concerning the tabernacle and temple. And we can be fairly brief at this point because we already talked about its association with the original mountain of God in Genesis 1 in Genesis 2. So the only thing I want to focus on at this moment for the tabernacle and the temple is how the tabernacle and temple themselves are meant to be representations of the mountain of God. Exodus chapter 24 gives to us a covenant ratification ceremony. It's kind of an original worship service that is going to be translated over into the tabernacle worship service. And as it does so, Exodus 24 gives us a tripartite structure of the mountain of God. We're at the base of the mountain. All of the nation of Israel is gathered together, where an altar is constructed, the covenants of God is read and proclaimed, and the sacrifice is offered up upon the altar. And then, after that initial service at the altar, Moses, Joshua, Aaron and his two sons, as well as the 70 elders as representatives of Israel, then ascend partway up the mountain where they partake of a fellowship meal in the presence of God. As they look up, they actually see a pavement that looks like sapphire, which is the same language as Ezekiel chapter 1 for the chariot throne room of God. And then after that, the full ascent is conducted only by Moses and Joshua. Or Moses and Joshua arise and then went up in the mountain of God, Exodus 24, 13. Looking at it in this way, Exodus 24 forms sort of an archetypal worship service at Mount Sinai that is then reflected in the worship service of the tabernacle. Where at the tabernacle, the altar is to be constructed at the original, or in front of, the entrance into the tabernacle. And then after you enter into the tabernacle, you have the initial courts and separated by a curtain from the court into the Holy of Holies, a holy place, and then a most holy place. And the most holy place is the third tier, likened unto the summit of Mount Sinai. And even when the tabernacle is finally constructed, and it's in Exodus chapter 40, the same flame-filled and fire and cloud-filled presence from Mount Sinai descends down and dwells in the Holy of Holies of the tabernacle. The tabernacle, in a sense, is a horizontalized mountain of God. It is the tabernacle and its attendant worship is an ascent into the mountain of God through the sacrificial system and the liturgy of ancient Israel. The association between the mountain of God and the tabernacle and temple is even more clear when we think of the temple and the land. In Deuteronomy chapter 12, the Lord tells his people that they are only to worship him in the place that he chooses. And we find the place where God chooses revealed to us in 1 Chronicles chapter 21. Remarkably, the only place where David sins in the entire narrative of 1 Chronicles. Samuel has other sins of his mentioned, but 1 Chronicles 21 is the only place where David sins in the narrative of Chronicles. And I think what happens here, we actually have David following through with a reiteration of the fall, where Satan comes, incites David to sin, just as Satan came and incited Adam to sin. Satan comes and confronts the terms of the covenant of works with Adam, the covenant of grace with David. And David, the representative, succumbs, just as Adam, the covenant representative, succumbed in Genesis chapter 3. And in light of that, judgment comes upon man, Genesis 3, and it comes upon Israel, 1 Chronicles 21. And that judgment is that a sword-bearing angel comes and starts to wield death against the people of God. However, as that sword-bearing angel is dealing the judgment of death upon the people of God in 1 Chronicles 21, a remarkable thing happens. As the angel of death is poised to strike the city of David and to destroy the city of Jerusalem, the earthly Zion, the Lord stays his hand. He stays his hand, and where the angel is located, the Lord instructs David to go to build an altar and to offer up a substitutionary sacrifice. As David goes and does so, and offers up the sacrifice in the stead of the people of Israel, a remarkable thing happens. The sword of the Lord, for the first time in redemptive history, is returned back to its sheath. Drawn against man due to the fall in Genesis chapter 3, is now returned to its sheath in 1 Chronicles chapter 21. And what's truly remarkable about it is 1 Chronicles 21 ends by saying, this is the place where the temple is to be located. God's choosing of the special place of his dwelling, Deuteronomy 12, is the place or man is to ascend in the presence of God through a substitutionary sacrifice, where the sword of the Lord is returned back to its sheath, and the way back into communion and union with God is opened up once again. Ascent from the altar by the substitutionary sacrifice is a way for man to ascend back into the presence of God in accordance with how God calls his people to worship him. See, this is the significance of the Levitical order of sacrifices in Leviticus chapter 1 through 5. Ascent up the mountain of God through a sacrifice offered upon the altar must be done in accordance with how God reveals himself in these five chapters, in these six chapters, Leviticus 1 through 5 and on into even into chapter 8 and 9. See, the function of the sacrificial system is itself to provide the means by which man may ascend into the presence of God. And briefly mentioning the three main sacrifices of their system draws our attention to this. And I'm following here the work of Morales in his book, Who Shall Ascend the Mountain of the Lord, where he sets the entire liturgical system of Leviticus and its sacrificial system here under the idiom of ascending into the presence of God. Or after the various sin and guilt offerings would have been offered to confess particular sins, the standard liturgy is one of ascent. So the burnt offering in Leviticus chapter 1, through the offering of a bull, a male goat, sheep, or birds without blemish, was for the purpose of atonement, to atone for one's sins and therefore make them holy, so that they could dwell in the presence of the Lord. Significantly, the Hebrew noun for what we translate as the burnt offering is olah, which comes from the verb olah, which means to ascend or to go up. You see, we name the sacrifice by virtue of what is done to the sacrifice, a burnt offering. But the Hebrew conception is actually based upon what is done to the worshiper. Through the offering up of the sacrifice, they ascend into the presence of God. This is an ascent offering. By offering it up on the altar, through the various rites in Leviticus chapter 1, the worshiper's sins are atoned for, and they are brought up into the presence of the Lord. This is why the whole sacrifice must be offered up upon the altar. This is why the blood needs to be manipulated and sprinkled upon the altar so that the full worshiper can be brought into the presence of the Lord. In fact, there's a technical term for the practice of burning a sacrifice in Hebrew, which can be glossed simply as to make a sacrifice smoke. And so through the burning up of the sacrifice, the offering itself is transmuted into smoke and ascends as that pleasing aroma to the Lord. The grain offering, also called the cereal offering in Leviticus chapter 2, adds an additional element to it that once you have ascended into the presence of God through the ascent offering, the grain offering, the cereal offering, is one of covenant fidelity to the Lord. The term translated here, a technical term in Leviticus, deals with this particular type of offering, but outside of Leviticus, it carries the connotation of a tribute as something you might bring before a king. And so this offering is a testimony of covenant submission. After having been brought into the presence of the King of Glory, the worshiper now submits themselves to the covenant Lord. This is why I think the first fruits are listed among these various grain offerings in chapter 2, verses 14 through 16. Because the first fruit offerings was meant to show that the land actually belonged to the divine sovereign above all else. Significantly, only a handful of this offering is offered up on the burnt altar, Leviticus chapter 2. The rest is given as a provision for the priest in chapter 2, verse 3. Now, pragmatically, this deals with the need of provision for the priest where they get their livelihood from their service in the tabernacle or the temple. But it's also theologically significant because joined with the sacrificial system is also the provision of food. While presented before the Lord, the priest and the cereal offering are now brought to the table as well. And this being brought to the table is significant for the third sacrifice, the peace offering, in Leviticus chapter 3. For the final approach offering, which is offered on a number of occasions, including a normal liturgical offering, the fulfillment of a vow, or even as a freewill offering, is similar to the ascent offering in how the worshiper brings an animal without blemish, they'll lay their hands on it, they'll slaughter it, but then the blood is thrown against the altar, but then the pattern deviates. Only the fat portions are offered up as a peace offering upon the altar. Then the priests are given a portion, just like with the grain offering, and their portion is the right thigh and the breast. But then, according to Deuteronomy 12, verse 7, which refers back to this legislation, a remarkable element is added to the peace offering. And the remarkable element added to the peace offering is that the worshiper is himself brought to the table. There you shall eat before the Lord your God, and you shall rejoice. That's the significance of these sacrifices being food offerings to the Lord. It's not because the Lord needs food. It's not because he's hungry. It's because what the Lord is doing is he's setting a table with his people, and he's summoning them into his presence. And as they ascend the mountain of God through the ascent offering, as they covenanted themselves through the cereal offering, now in the peace offering, they partake of a communion meal with God in his presence. You see, the sacrificial system set within the idiom of ascending the mountain of the Lord is the revealed means by which the people of Israel, in accordance with God's word, as an act of worship, would ascend the mountain of God, covenant themselves to the Lord in glory, and partake of a fellowship meal with him on his mountain. And this is actually why in Hebrew the term for offering is korban, which means to which draws from the verb korav, to draw near. It is the means by which the Lord brings his people nearer unto himself. See, once man is exiled off the mountain of God, only God can reveal the way you can now be brought near. Only God can reveal a pattern of redemption through substitutionary sacrifice that looks forward to his son bearing that sacrifice himself. That way he can bring his people back near to himself. That the wages of sin would be paid for. That a sinner could be renewed in the image of God and restored to communion with the Lord, marked by a fellowship meal in these sacrifices. Israel's worship was a worship of ascent into the presence of God through a sacrifice at the altar. But this earthly tabernacle, this earthly temple, were but copies of the heavenly things, the author of Hebrews says in Hebrews 9, 23. And these copies of earthly things needed to be purified and administered with earthly rites of sacrifice. And so the earthly copies served even in the days of Old Testament Israel to sow the hope of the heaven reality, which those sacrifices and that temple itself looked forward to for the Old Testament saints. Through these Old Covenant types and shadows, the substance of the covenant of grace, which is Christ himself, was made known to them and confirmed to them. They looked forward to Christ and they found the efficacy of the sacrifices in the Christ to whom they looked. But now, in our redemptive historical context, the substance has come. And so the way of approaching God has reached its telos. It has reached its goal. Christ's death and the once-for-all sacrifice of himself brought an end to the types and the shadows of the Old Covenant. Just as the sacrificial system brought Old Covenant worshipers up the mountain of God into the presence of God where they fellowshiped with God, so also Christ's final climactic once-for-all sacrifice. As our priest and our king, after the order of Melchizedek, through his sacrifice, he serves as a minister in the holy places. Hear what the author of Hebrews says in chapter 8, verse 2. And the true tent that the Lord set up, and not man. Jesus' ascent through sacrifice was not into the temple of Jerusalem, and it was not of an earthly Zion, but to the heavenly one. To the true tent, the heavenly Zion, that was copied and shadowed in the Old Testament. Christ's ascension into heaven is perhaps the most significant redemptive historical act that is overlooked by Christians today. See, his substitutionary death and his subsequent resurrection are progressing toward an ascent to the heavenly mountain of God. And as he does so, it's a restoration of heavenly union and communion with God through our mediator, which is Christ, the second and the last Adam. Christ's entrance into the heavenly places was by means of his blood, through which he secured for us an eternal redemption, Hebrews 9, verse 12. His sacrifice, the offering up of his own life in fulfillment of all the promises of God, and even in light of the entire sacrificial system, brought him to heaven itself, where he appears in the presence of God on our behalf as the mediator of the new covenant. And as it is impossible for the blood of bulls and goats to take away sins, Hebrews 10:4, the blood of Christ, to whom they looked, was necessary for salvation, and won salvation both for us and for the Old Testament saints. And here's the remarkable part. Because of Christ's ascent into heaven as our mediator, as our prophet, priest, and king, the author of Hebrews says, we have confidence to enter the holy places by the blood of Jesus. See, it is through the sacrifices that we draw near with a true heart and full assurance of faith. In spirit-wrought faith union with Christ, Christians are brought up the mountain of God. And that mountain is not the earthly Zion, but the heavenly one. And this isn't just a future reality that is held out in hope to the saints at the end of the age, although that is true. It's also an integral part of the church's present worship. In Hebrews chapter 12, the author tells us how in Christ we have come to what may not be touched. And after talking about the theophany of Sinai, he concludes his discussion there saying that you have come to Mount Zion, to the city of the living God, to the, hear this, heavenly Jerusalem, and to the innumerable angels in festal gathering, and to the assembly of the firstborn who are enrolled in heaven, and to God, the judge of all, and to the spirits of the righteous made perfect, and to Jesus, the mediator of the new covenant, and to the sprinkled blood that speaks a better word than the blood of Abel. Through the work of Christ, our mediator, when the church gathers together as the people of God for corporate worship on earth, they spiritually are brought to that assembly of the firstborn in heaven. Christians ascend in worship through the sacrifice of Christ, through his mediatorial work, through his blood being shed, the heavenly rather than the earthly Zion. And because of that work of Christ applied to us by the Spirit today, we have every confidence to draw near now, and every confidence that we'll be drawn near climactically when Christ returns. And this is why, through the ascent of the heavenly Zion by the power of the Spirit, the church is identified today as the temple of God here on earth. The temple of God is marked by the residence of the Spirit of God. It's that way in Genesis 1. It's that way in Exodus chapter 40. It's that way in 1 Kings chapter 8. It's that way in 2 Chronicles chapter 7. And it's that way today as well. Where the Spirit of God dwells, the temple of God is located. And the Spirit of God dwells in the people of God in this age. Paul makes this clear in Ephesians chapter 2, verses 11 and 22, where he argues that through union with Christ, both Jews and Gentiles are brought near unto the Lord, and that the dividing wall of hostility has been broken down between them. And as such, Christ is preached to both Jew and Gentile alike. And he says that we all have access in one Spirit to the Father. Christians become, he says, members of the household of God, built on the foundation of the apostles and prophets, Christ himself being the cornerstone, in whom the whole structure being joined grows together into the holy temple of the Lord. In him also you are being built together into a dwelling place for God by the Holy Spirit. Through faith. Through faith in the crucified, risen, and ascended Christ, the whole church becomes the dwelling place, the temple of God, by the power of the Holy Spirit. And as Peter continues to say in 1 Peter chapter 2, Christians are therefore living stones built together into Christ as a spiritual house, a holy priesthood, to offer spiritual sacrifices acceptable to God through Christ. See, this biblical theology of sacred space is actually very important for the life of the believer today, isn't it? It identifies the church as the special place of God's dwelling by the power of the Spirit, And it tells us that in our corporate worship, we ascend into the heavenly presence of God and adore our Lord in the heavenly places, in the heavenly Zion, ascending into His presence with our praise. Through the power of the Spirit, by the means of the mediatorial work of Christ, we are brought up the mountain of the Lord.
Thank you for listening to this lesson from Reformed Academy. We trust it has been a blessing to you, and we encourage you to use this course in your church or otherwise share it with others who may benefit from this teaching. At Reformed Forum, we are committed to providing redemptive, historical, biblical, and theological education freely to people around the world. All of our courses are available online at reformedforum.org, many with Spanish and Chinese subtitles, all entirely for free. If you would like to support our mission and help us continue offering these valuable resources, please visit reformedforum.org/donate. With your partnership, more people can access sound, Reformed teaching, and together, by God's grace, we can equip the next generation of church leaders for faithful service.